It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickett will be back on the air with me tomorrow. Coming up in Wisconsin Legends, a look at the life and political career of Fighting Bob La Follette, governor, senator, progressive candidate for president, among other things. First, a new poll out today from the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee's Center for Urban Initiatives and Research finds that 63% of Milwaukee metro residents oppose state funding for a new arena for the Milwaukee Bucks, and 53% oppose spending state money on development of infrastructure related to a new arena. Could be bad news for the future of the franchise in the city. Previous reports have suggested that a new arena is key to keeping the Bucks in Milwaukee. Our next guest is confident, though, that a deal for an arena can be struck and could pay dividends for the city. We're joined now by Tim Sheehy, president of the Metropolitan Milwaukee Association of Commerce. Tim, welcome to Central Time.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be with you this afternoon.
So this new poll, 63% of residents in the Milwaukee metro area opposed to state funding for a new arena, a higher percentage opposed when you look statewide. Bad news from your perspective. What's your reaction?
No, I don't think it's bad news. Especially in the Milwaukee area here, the survey only asked 162 people, and the 53-45 spread is within the 8-point margin of error. And I really think for local politics here, if you took out the Racine area, which nobody is expecting to participate in the financing of a new downtown arena, you would change the results of that survey. But the point is, we've got a lot of work to do. It's very early on, and we need to make a compelling case, and I think we can do that.
For people who are unconvinced, what's the case you think you need to make to them?
Sure. The case I think that we need to make is that we have, as a region, as a metropolitan area, you can expand it further as a state, we're in a race to improve our economic prosperity. And there are going to be clearly winners and losers in that race. And Milwaukee is the flagship city, as a flagship region in Wisconsin, accounts for more than a third of the state's revenues, more than a third of the state's population, and more than a third of the state's economy. And what is going to make this region successful is our ability to attract and retain and develop the diverse talent that our economy needs. And if we're going to do that, part of the emphasis we have to place is on reinvesting in our cultural and entertainment assets that help make this an attractive location for the kind of talent that's going to drive growth in our future. And we view that a downtown entertainment center that can draw in excess of 2 million visitors, has a significant economic impact, and puts us on a global stage is an asset that's worth investing in, both private and public dollars.
And you've used the phrase entertainment center. Is this just going to be a place for the Bucks to play basketball? If not, what else will this be used for?
Sure. I mean, the Bucks are clearly the marquee name on it, as it's an NBA arena. But there are only 40 dates that an NBA team plays in a market. And so when I call it a downtown entertainment center, it is truly the appropriate moniker for a venue like this. There are concerts that are brought in from national concerts, from the national concert circuit, that won't stop here without a venue. There are community events. There are meetings. It's a facility that's used 200 plus days a year. And I think in a re-envisioned and new facility, it could connect even better with the community than it does right now. And all that activity brings in new dollars to the state. It brings in new revenue. Just as one example, the basketball players that play in the arena produce almost $7 million a year in income tax for the state alone. So there are lots of economic spinoffs from this kind of an investment.
A lot of people look at public money for a sports arena and entertainment venue in this case and say, hey, there's a lot of money in the league for the owners, the players. Why do we need to tap into public funds to help build it?
Yeah, and it's a great question. And of the last over the last 15 years, there have been 13 NBA facilities built. The average public sector contribution is 69%. I think we're gonna beat that significantly, and we should with a larger private sector share. But these communities all over the United States are doing this because it is a unique business. It's an attractive asset for a community. It puts those communities that have it, there are only 27 in the United States, it puts them on a global stage, and they have made the decision, and we're going to have to make the similar decision, is it worth some kind of public support? And again, I think the public support here will be far less than what other communities have had to do.
Are you looking at just state coffers being tapped here or some kind of regional tax? What exactly would be the form of the public money?
Well, again, I think we're looking at a combination of the best way to do this. We have talked about the potential of a sales tax. The advantage to that is that a third of that is going to be paid by residents who don't live here. That's a very positive thing. I just gave you an idea of how the state benefits from the tax revenue generated from this activity. So that's a possibility. And I think that your listeners need to know that the current entertainment center, the Bradley Center, is a state-owned facility. And it's a state-owned facility that for most of its 25 years has drawn no revenue from the state of Wisconsin. It's only recently, in the last couple of years, that the state has begun to put in some money to help maintain a facility that it is the owner of, for lack of a better word. So as we look forward to the next 25 or 30 years, that facility could require $100 to $125 million in upkeep and investment. And so part of the question we're asking, is that a smart investment for the state, or are we better putting something like that into a new facility that will give us a better chance to be successful?
There has been talk from community groups in Milwaukee over the last couple of months saying, in effect, if we're going to put lots of money in for the Bucks to play basketball, can this project include new, improved, rehabilitated recreational facilities for kids in Milwaukee? Can you see that being rolled into the project?
Well, what I can see and what I see right now is a vibrant discussion in this community about what we need to do to remain attractive, to develop the talent we have, and to attract people into the area and into the region. And so this is not just about a new place to play basketball. We have a vibrant discussion here about how we fund our cultural institutions, the zoo, the museum, the performing arts center, our parks. All those are vital assets, and I think this is a much broader discussion for us at the local level here in the Milwaukee area that extends beyond just a new downtown entertainment center. And we're just beginning that conversation, but we're very pleased with the reaction I think we're getting so far.
The similar battle over Miller Park a while back led to a state senator being recalled pretty much over that one issue. Are politicians, do you think, going to be willing to stick their necks out to support public funding of this new arena?
Yeah, and I happened to be sitting in George Petak's office before he walked out to take that vote, and I think it was a courageous thing to do.
No kidding.
He may have painted himself into a bit of a box by saying he wasn't going to vote for it, but I think if you look back at the situation we had at the time, drawing a little over 1.5 million people to County Stadium, you had a team that wasn't playing very well. The league was about to go on strike, and the prospects were not very bright. I'll fast forward to today. The Brewers are 5 games ahead in the division, and I think you would be hard-pressed to find anybody in the Milwaukee area who doesn't think Miller Park was a fantastic investment, that it's a great asset for the region. And what it's cost most residents in the region, they probably have more change that's fallen out of their pocket under their car seats than it cost them for that kind of an investment.
What does the community lose? What does the Milwaukee region lose if the Bucks ultimately don't get the stadium and move elsewhere?
I don't think Milwaukee is a one-horse town. It is not dependent solely on the Brewers or the Bucks or the Symphony or the Public Museum or our park system. But what we lose is we take a step back. that this community has had an NBA team for 35 plus years. It's been an asset. It's part of our it's part of what we sell. And I'm a big believer that we should take care of our assets and reduce our liabilities. And I don't want to see us go backwards by losing an asset that we have. And I think a modest public investment as a part of the private sector investment going in here will help secure that asset for us going forward and allow us to build and repair some of the other public institutions that need support.
Tim, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You bet. Anytime.
That was Tim Sheehy, president of the Metropolitan Milwaukee Association of Commerce. This weekend is the birthday of Wisconsin legend Robert M. La Follette Sr., better known as Fighting Bob. He was a man who touched a lot of bases in Wisconsin politics, serving as a member of the U.S. House of Representatives, U.S. Senator from Wisconsin, and governor of the state. And he ran for president of the United States as the nominee of the Progressive Party in 1924. As Wisconsin gears up for another gubernatorial election, we'll look back on the influential career of Fighting Bob La Follette. Our guest is Jonathan Kasparek. He's professor of history at the UW-Waukesha and author of Fighting Phil, a biography of Philip La Follette. Welcome to Central Time.
Thanks.
So how did Fighting Bob's experience growing up in Wisconsin as a student at UW-Madison influence his politics?
Well, he was the first governor born in the state, grew up in Dane County, and the first to attend the University of Wisconsin, where he was actually quite a bad student. he was a good student, I should say, just not in the classroom.
Right. Did he have trouble making it all the way through college, given his poor classroom experience?
Well, it was a very close thing. In those days, the faculty met and voted individually on each graduate, and he had a tie vote until President John Bascom decided that he should pass. So he became part of the class of 1879.
So squeaking through college, how did he then get into politics?
Well, he built on what he did in college. He wasn't a great student academically, but he was a very popular student and learned that he had a knack for organizing. He bought the student paper and began organizing a political campaign for student government. He became the winner of an interstate oratorical competition and became a campus hero. So he learned that he had the ability to motivate people to speak and speak well.
And then what was his first foray into electoral politics, trying to get into office?
His first elected office was district attorney of Dane County in 1880, after he had been a lawyer for just over a year. And he did it mostly because he needed the money at an $800 salary, I think, and that was what he wanted.
Now, over time, he became involved with the state's Republican Party, but he wasn't apparently wild about the direction the party was taking. How did he become an agitator?
He became an agitator early on. The story that he tells in 1880, he decides he's going to run for district attorney and has a confrontation with the postmaster of Madison, Elisha Keyes, who said, "I hear you're running for district attorney, and we have somebody else lined up already." La Follette decided that he wasn't going to let any one person stand in his way, so he started doing the rounds. He went to every farm in Dane County that he could and met all the voters and got the nomination over the boss.
And was this pretty much a one-party state at that point? If you got the Republican nomination, you were more or less a shoo-in?
It really was, and I think that's where the Republicans really ran a risk, because they started taking voters for granted. And La Follette learned that if he appealed directly to the voters on a one-to-one basis and went out and shook hands, he could convince them that he would be more interested and look out for their interests better than the party bosses that they'd been voting for.
So apart from working against the party, I don't think we could call it a machine quite, but what issues was he starting to take up around that time in that district attorney race and ones that followed soon after?
When he's running for district attorney, and then later when he serves in the House of Representatives, he's not really an insurgent yet. He's a pretty typical Republican. He is a law and order Republican. The big issue in the 1880 election was what they called the tramp menace, too many unemployed men from the Depression of 1873 roaming the countryside. When he's in the House of Representatives, he votes, as Republicans do, for a high tariff. You get a little glimmer of his independent streak, some of the lumber interest and the railroad interest in Wisconsin saw the Menominee Reservation as a great source of timber, and he kind of stopped them from getting that land. But he's not really an insurgent yet. The big change comes in 1891.
What happened then?
1890 is an unusual year. It's the one of the few years that the Republicans lose, and the Democrats suddenly find themselves with the governorship, the legislature, and most of the congressional delegation, and LaFollette finds himself unemployed. It turns out that the Republicans had been engaging in a kind of a nice graft. They had the control of the treasurer's office, and they kept the interest on all of the state's deposits and used it kind of as a party slush fund. When the Democrats took over in 1891, they filed a lawsuit to reclaim all of that money, and a lot of Republicans stood to lose a lot. And one of those Republicans is the former U.S. Senator Philetus Sawyer, who summons young Bob LaFollette to Milwaukee for a meeting, pulls out a wad of cash and says, "Here, you need to fix this." And LaFollette assumed that he's being offered a bribe to influence the case, which is being held in a Dane County courtroom, in a court presided over by his brother-in-law. So suddenly he realizes politics are corrupt and decides that he's going to be the crusader against corruption.
So at what point, that kicked off a long career on issues of corruption and the influence of money in politics, where did he get the nickname Fighting Bob?
Because he kept fighting. He goes to the Republican state conventions. He wants to run for governor, and the bosses keep pushing him down through one case, the bribery. In another case, they rig the convention against him. And he keeps going back every 2 years to fight them. And he's very strident. He won't compromise. He wants to be elected, and he wants to be a reformer.
How effective, when he finally made it into the governor's office, how effective was he there? Did he have to compromise a lot once he was in the governor's chair?
He didn't really compromise a whole lot. But back then, of course, governors were two-year terms, so he's up for re-election in 1902 right away. Didn't actually get a lot done his first term because he refused to compromise. So he goes over the politician's head and campaigns and tells people, if you want to get anything done, vote for candidates who will support my agenda. Hmm. And he's much more successful in his second term when he gets tax reform in place, what was called ad valorem taxation, where the railroads and other corporations would be taxed on the value of their property. He gets a primary election law passed where the voters will choose a candidate for the party rather than a convention. So he does get what he wants, and mostly because he refuses to compromise.
Then he goes on to the U.S. Senate, and I've seen lists that historians and some others have done of most influential, important senators in history, and he is often up there on that list. What was his legacy in the Senate?
His great legacy in the Senate really is to continue being the spokesperson for farmers, working men, people who really have been left out of the great prosperity of the Gilded Age. He's probably most famous for opposing U.S. entry into World War I, which almost ruined his career, but not quite.
And then looking ahead, you've written about fighting Phil. How did his family carry on his political agenda?
Well, Phil, of course, goes on to be elected governor in 1930 and has a whole host of reforms that he introduces as well, including the nation's first unemployment compensation law that goes on to become kind of a blueprint for the rest of the country. His son, Bob Jr., becomes senator in 1925 and serves until 1946 and is also very well regarded as one of the greatest U.S. senators.
And let's talk about his legacy in just the last couple of decades. I've certainly heard Democrats style themselves as the heir to Fighting Bob. I've seen a couple of Republicans paint themselves as mavericks, too, people who are willing to buck their own party. Do people still want to pick up the mantle of Fighting Bob in Wisconsin?
Well, Wisconsin voters seem to really like those kinds of politicians that are willing to be independent. And you're right, both Democrats and Republicans sort of claim that insurgency and that populism. Bill Proxmire was a great example of that throughout his career. We've seen it in others as well.
We'll leave it there for now. A lot more that we didn't get to. Thank you for spending time with us today.
I'm glad to do it.
That's Jonathan Kasparek. He's a historian at UW-Waukesha and author of Fighting Phil, a biography of Philip La Follette. We've been talking about the life, political career, and legacy of Fighting Bob La Follette. His birthday, the anniversary of his birthday, is this Saturday. We're talking about some intriguing new research that could lead to a drug that could more or less cure us of love and related heartaches. While we're a long way off from medications that would target one specific romantic relationship, there are existing drugs that interfere with some of the specific aspects of romance, like sexual desire and connection, and brain science could point the way to further developments. Researchers are looking into how these and other medications prescribed, maybe in a special timed way, could become, in effect, an anti-love drug. Here to explain this research is Brian D. Earp. He's research fellow at the Oxford Uehiro Center for Practical Ethics. Brian, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much for having me. Hello.
Well, when we first read about this around here, the first thing that we thought of when thinking about an anti-love or a fix-it drug is the movie Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. A company helps people erase painful memories. Here's a clip.
Why remember a destructive love affair? Here at Lacuna, we have perfected a safe, effective technique for the focused erasure of troubling memories. Our patented non-surgical procedure will rid you of painful memories and allow you a new and lasting peace of mind you never imagined possible.
Brian, I know we're not at the point of removing a specific string of memories. What are we talking about in post-love, anti-love medications?
Well, to follow up on the example of memory modification, this provides a good lesson for how these drugs might work, because many of them might not be developed for the specific purpose of sort of blocking or diminishing feelings of love, but might potentially have those effects based on drugs that were designed for other purposes. So to explain that, memory modification is something that scientists are working on right now as a treatment for post-traumatic stress disorder. So soldiers coming back from war, having these traumatic memories, and scientists are very interested in seeing how can we try to basically block or deaden or dull the traumatic aspect of these past memories. Well, if we have that capacity, if that is available, and it looks like we can partially achieve this effect, you can imagine that some people might think, well, I have traumatic memories from a relationship that I was in, very much as was dramatized in that movie. And so this is the sort of thing that's going to be more and more a focus for research moving forward, and memory modification would just be one aspect of that.
And you look at love and the brain, kind of pro and con in a lot of ways. Let's get to the basics. The poets don't write about oxytocin levels and things like that. How much is love coming from specific weird bits of our brain that we can find, measure, and maybe turn on and off?
Well, in a kind of trivial sense, everything that we experience is explainable in terms of events that are going on in our brains. So unless you think that our feelings and our emotions and our attachments to other people are sort of floating off above our heads somewhere in a kind of magical other realm.
That way sometimes.
Well, it does, of course. You know, all of our personal experiences feel like they're kind of, you know, coming from our soul in some way. But what scientists are starting to uncover is that whatever your conception of love is, however you experience it, if you interfere with brain systems that are related to those kind of higher level experiences, you can affect changes in them. So they started doing research in this area with simpler animal systems. So humans are very complex. We have a lot going on that some other animals don't. But they found that they could manipulate whether these little rodents called voles would form attachments with each other, basically whether they would form a pair bond, like a monogamous pair bond. And when they started to analyze the parts of the brain that were controlling this behavior in these animals, they saw that they could manipulate it by either blocking the effects of these brain chemicals or by introducing these brain chemicals. And they could basically make them form an attachment or not. Now, humans are more complicated. It's not clear whether we have the exact same machinery going on in our brains. But a lot of scientists think we have pretty similar structures there. And there's now some research coming out suggesting that we might be able to kind of enhance or diminish the same sorts of parts of the brain that exist in these other animals, potentially, you know, increasing or decreasing our feelings of attachment, lust, love, sort of across a range of conceptions about how we actually kind of think about and conceptualize our experience of love, which, of course, is the sort of thing that poets are writing about.
And one element that maybe might make people feel a little uncomfortable, apparently parts of the brain involved in romantic relationships are similar to the parts of the brain involved in addiction. How similar are those two situations in terms of how our brains work?
Well, there's been some recent research which suggests that the feeling of being romantically in love with someone is very similar to what it's like to experience the effects of certain drugs that are sometimes called addictive drugs. These would be drugs like cocaine and so on. Basically, the experience of being in love and also the experience of some of these drugs floods our reward system in our brain with chemicals like dopamine, which people have heard about. And as with drugs, sometimes relationships can be so pleasurable in a sense, in that they make us want to keep returning to that person, that it can kind of overwhelm our better judgment about other areas in our lives. And so some people describe their experience of being in certain relationships as being very much like an addiction. So that sort of as a cliche or as a metaphor has been around for a while. But what's interesting is that scientists are starting to demonstrate that in terms of what's going on in the brain, it's very similar. In terms of how the brain chemicals are acting when you're addicted to a person as when you're addicted to a drug.
And one possible application of medications could be to end that addiction, whether it's to an unrequited love or post-breakup, or even, I've seen suggestions, a connection, that addiction to someone, an abusive partner in a harmful relationship. How would that work? How would medications work to help break those?
Yeah, so I think sometimes people think that if you're in love with someone, you kind of should just follow your feelings, that there's some sort of deeper truth to that feeling of love. And of course, in many cases, that might be true. But also in the case of a domestic abuse situation, sometimes our feelings can lead us in the wrong direction. And we know that for many people, they might be in really dangerous situations, but they feel so attached to the person that they can't really pull themselves away. And they might really continue to be in a situation that's really threatening to their overall well-being. And so in this sort of situation, you might think there's a really good reason to try to change the feelings. There's a really good reason to try to pull yourself away from this other person. And if some of these drugs that we've been doing some research into could have that effect, then there might be a good moral reason to use them in some cases. Now, how might they work? Well, there are current drugs that have side effects that already achieve some of these outcomes. So one example is antidepressant medication. Now, a well-known side effect for some forms of antidepressant medication is that it can interfere with libido, so it can basically lower your sex drive. And this is usually considered a side effect, obviously not something that people are seeking out when they use this drug. But another thing it can do for some people is it can sort of block their higher-level feelings of care or concern or worry about their partner, for example. And so many people describe the effects of antidepressant medication as being sort of negative for their romantic partnership. And again, that's seen as a side effect, something bad that they don't want to happen. But on the other hand, if you were in a relationship that you wanted to end and you actually were seeking to try to diminish or block these feelings of attachment, then we have a kind of proof of principle in that we have currently existing drugs that, at least for some people, do in fact have that kind of effect. And the question is, could we harness this information and try to figure out why it's happening in some cases and use it deliberately for cases where people are in, as we said, violent or abusive relationships, and they're actually seeking for a way to turn off those feelings?
In a less dramatic scenario, most of us, I think, have been through some kind of painful breakup or another. Is there use? Would it be the same kind of drugs to help break that attachment, take away the edge of the sorrow of the breakup?
So that's the sort of outcome that seems possible and even likely based on the way that these drugs are shaping up. the question is going to be whether that's a good idea or under what conditions it would be a good idea. So you can sort of imagine that if you've gone through a terrible relationship and you've gone through a breakup that's been really hard, that you might be tired of feeling sad all the time and you want to turn to a drug to try to, as you said, take the edge off those feelings. But of course, sometimes the reason why we're feeling that way is because it's our brains trying to tell us that we need to pay attention to what happened. You know, why are we having all this suffering? Well, maybe we need to learn something from that. So there might be some cases where the suffering based on a relationship is so extreme and so prolonged that it's not instrumental to helping you learn and grow. But I think one thing to be very cautious about, if and when these drugs become available, is people turning to them as sort of a quick fix, when what they really need to do is to kind of process that suffering and make sense of it in their lives.
We're talking to Brian Earp from Oxford University about the potential for an anti-love drug, or drugs that can limit the impact of feelings of love and heartbreak, and the ethics surrounding those drugs as they may emerge onto the market. We want to hear from you. Would you ever take something like this? Was there a situation in your life where, looking back, you would have loved to have taken a pill to numb that heartache after a breakup? Are you excited by this idea, or do you find it a little creepy? Call in now and share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also send us an email, talk@WPR.org, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're picking up our discussion with Brian Earp from Oxford University about research he's doing into the possibility of an anti-love drug. He's also looking at the ethical implications of drugs that numb, remove some of the impact of heartbreak or unrequited love, maybe. We're taking your calls now. Have you ever been in a situation where you might have considered taking something like that if it had been available? Something to take the sting out of that breakup? Why or why not? Do you have philosophical or ethical thoughts or questions about this concept? Call in now and share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to our callers now. We've got Mary on the line in Cedarburg. Mary, hi.
Hello.
What do you think about this?
Well, I just wanted to say that I think the whole idea is very dangerous, and it could be very dehumanizing. I know I haven't had a lot of rough emotional patches of my life, so I feel like I might not be as qualified as somebody who's lived a very hard life to talk about such a thing, but I think that emotions and our own control of our own emotions is one of those things that makes us very human, and it's very important to help us grow as people, to be hurt and to understand that hurt and to work through it and let it make us stronger. So I think that a sort of drug like this would be very harmful from a, I guess, philosophical, ethical standpoint.
Mary, thanks for the call. And Brian, that's echoing a little bit of what you were saying just a few minutes ago.
Yeah, that's right. With any new drug or technology, there's the possibility for misuse and abuse. One example is antidepressant medication. Sometimes people take this drug as a way to kind of numb their feelings rather than facing their sadness. But at the same time, I think there are some people for whom antidepressant medication is the difference between being able to function and participate in life at all, and being kind of gripped by a debilitating sadness. And so I think in extreme cases where the value of the suffering is probably not going to be instrumental to improving the person's life and helping them learn, then there could be an argument in those cases for using these drugs. But I agree with the caller that they're certainly not the sort of thing that should be used flippantly as a way to avoid dealing with these core human problems.
I know you consider some possible misuses, thinking of maybe a parent not liking the love interest of their teenage kid or wanting to keep a kid focused on schoolwork and not crushes. How could something like this be misused?
Yeah, I think because there is that sort of danger, it's really important to emphasize that these drugs should be taken voluntarily, if at all. But you can imagine some cases where it might really help someone achieve an important goal in terms of changing their emotions or their inner feelings. So an example of this is, let's say we were talking about someone who had sexual attraction to small children, somebody with pedophilic desires. Well, many people who have these feelings don't want them. They didn't choose them. They didn't wake up one morning and say, I really want to be attracted to small children. And some of them even have a really hard time controlling their behavior that's inspired by these feelings. And here's a case of a person who might say, if I could take a drug, if I could take some kind of substance that would help me remove these feelings of sexual attraction to someone that I might harm by acting on those feelings, and they were to volunteer to do that, I think that that would be a morally justifiable action. At the same time, we have a long history of, you know, psychiatric doctors labeling people with diseases and sort of forcing drugs on them, as happened for a long time with homosexuality. It was defined as a disease, an aggressive treatment, sometimes with biochemistry and technology, that could be very damaging and very harmful to people. So when we're dealing with really contentious technologies like this, we would certainly want to start out by strongly emphasizing the value of voluntariness, that the person would have to choose to do it and that they'd have good reason to do it.
We'll go back to our callers now. We've got Tracy on the line in Milwaukee. Tracy, hi.
Hi. I was calling to share my experience when I was put on antidepressants when I was in a very difficult time and I was diagnosed with PTSD. And at first I was really hesitant to go on the medication for some of those reasons, that taking away sexual desire and desire for romantic involvement. But it actually turned out to be such a relief, because it was such a difficult time in my life, then I didn't have to worry about that, and it wouldn't have been a good time to get in a relationship. And it was a little bit like I imagine taking a appetite suppressant if you were trying to diet. That need wasn't there, and I could focus on what I needed to do just to get better.
And Tracy, if I can ask a very personal question, did you take it just for a time in that difficult patch, or is it something you stayed on for quite a while?
I ended up staying on it. Things definitely got better, but I tried to go off it and I just didn't feel as good. So I've ended up staying on it. Mm-hmm. Well, actually, I did switch to one that had less of those side effects. Okay. So, yep, I'm in a healthy relationship. I'm engaged. So it hasn't affected me long term.
Okay. Well, Tracy, thank you so much and for letting me pry there, too. And I'm happy that it turned out well for you. I could see maybe some people just doing something like this for a short time, what we're calling on the show anti-love drugs, to get through a rough patch, or maybe going longer term as Tracy did for PTSD, Brian.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think the ideal case for any kind of drug that's potentially powerful, that's potentially has side effects, is to use it for a short period of time, long enough to kind of engage with those bigger picture questions about getting your life back on track. But of course, for some people, as illustrated by the case of the caller, sometimes a low dose that's used continuously throughout a long period of time may really help the person engage fully in life. And sometimes there's this notion that some drugs can be a threat to authenticity. And I think this was the problem raised by the caller about our humanness, mm-hmm. sort of a similar idea. But of course, sometimes if you consider yourself, you know, at your core to be a kind of lively person who's engaged in life, but you find something like depression, or you find something like some of these problems kind of inhibiting you from participating in life in the way that you see as being true to yourself, you could actually imagine that sometimes the use of a drug could help you feel more authentic. In other words, it could make you feel like yourself rather than like somebody who's overcome or overtaken by feelings that are not productive or that seem alien and that seem like they're sort of taking you over in a way. So it's going to be different for everybody. And drugs are never going to be a silver bullet. They always run the risk of being overprescribed. They always run the risk of having pharmaceutical companies trying to make money off of, you know, spreading disease labels that don't need to be spread around or that aren't accurate. So there are always dangers involved. But I think when we hear cases like the case described by the caller just now, we can remember that in some instances, these drugs can really make a big difference. And the key for ethics is to try to figure out how to increase the use of drugs for the cases where it really works and really is a good decision, and to really try to get rid of the use of drugs where they're abused or misused or being used as a crutch rather than as an instrument to flourishing.
If I know one thing about brains, Brian, it's that they're really complicated. I know the same antidepressant can affect two different people very differently. Does that make it really hard to target these solutions in the realm of love as in depression?
Yeah, definitely. So my colleagues and I have done some work not just on anti-love drugs, but on what you might call love drugs. In other words, substances that could potentially enhance states of mind or behavioral dispositions that could improve a relationship. And one drug that's commonly referred to in this conversation is oxytocin, which is a brain chemical that's released during sex and orgasm, and as well as in some other circumstances. And the point about oxytocin is that you can now spray it up your nose. It exists as a synthetic substance that you can kind of spray directly into the brain. And people thought about it initially as kind of a love drug, an enhancement drug, a pro-social drug. But what they found out more recently is it has very different effects on different people. And it kind of depends on what your personality style and traits are. So, for example, if you have a very aggressive personality style, what oxytocin can do for some people like this is actually increase their aggressiveness. So you can imagine if you're in a relationship where you're trying to take oxytocin with your partner, you know, with a counselor, let's say, sometime in the future, and the idea is to try to improve the relationship or increase the feeling of attachment, but actually it ends up just enhancing someone's aggressive tendencies in an already abusive relationship. Well, that would be a terrible intervention. You know, a drug is just strengthening what's already problematic about the relationship. So for any of these drugs to be used in a way that's beneficial rather than harmful, it's not going to be enough to just prescribe them willy-nilly, but rather to be very careful about who is taking them, what is the specific problem in the relationship, is the drug going to be the best strategy for addressing that problem, maybe in conjunction with other kind of non-pharmaceutical treatments. All those questions would have to be asked, and it's not the sort of thing that can be decided at an abstract level. It's very much going to hinge on the specifics.
Briefly, Brian, are we going to see new drugs along these lines coming out soon, or existing drugs repurposed and prescribed for the things we're talking about anytime soon?
Yeah, so that's interesting. A drug just is a drug, and what we think it's for is what we, you know, package it for. Mm-hmm. But the question is, what effects does it have? Oxytocin is currently being trialed as a sort of pro-relationship drug. That's happening. And there is currently the use of drugs to block libido for people with, as I described earlier, pedophilic tendencies. And so already these drugs do exist. I think that the research is going to become more concentrated and more focused on possible relationship drugs. And I think we're likely to see that in the coming years.
Brian, we'll leave it there, but we may talk to you again about those pro-love drugs sometime. Thanks so much for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me. Take care.
That was Brian D. Earp, research fellow at the Oxford Uhiro Center for Practical Ethics.